Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 562, titled Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on July 23rd of the year 2006. With the turmoil that has been overtaking the rest of the world and this country and all that's been going on, there has been much talk of the formal death of democracy, of the coming of fascism to America. I used to talk about my belief this country was descending into fascism, and people treated me as though I had a D blank, blank, blank growing out of my head. That is no longer the case. And indeed, as relatively staid a source as Harper's Magazine has in its forum section a, quote, a forum, surprise, surprise, in which a number of military experts are interviewed by a senior editor of Harper's Magazine, a fellow named Bill Wasik, W-A-S-I-K. The officers and experts were at a steakhouse in Arlington, Virginia in January of this year, and they were Andrew J. Bacevich, a professor of international relations at Boston University, and the author most recently of The New American Militarism. He served as an officer in the U.S. Army from 1969 to 1992. Brigadier General Charles J. Dunlap, Jr. is a staff judge advocate at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. In 1992, he published an essay entitled The Origins of the American Military Coup of 2012. His views here are personal and do not reflect those of the U.S. Department of Defense. By the way, that article is the focal point of an article I read into the record as part of a For the Record show titled "The Civilian Military Split." More about the members of this panel: Richard H. Cohn, K-O-H-N, is the chair of the curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and editor of the book The United States Military Under the Constitution of the United States, 1789 to 1989, among others. Edward Lutwak, L-U-T-T-W-A-K, is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the author of many books, including Coup d'etat, a practical handbook. And again, the moderator, Bill Wasik, a senior editor of Harper's Magazine. Now, what we're going to do is to resume with the reading of this article/forum. And Mr. Bacevich, but the military is also recruited, and it doesn't seem to me that the military has much interest in whether or not the force is representative of American society. Cohn, I don't think that's true. Bacevich, where do you think recruiting command is focused right now? It's focused on those evangelicals. It's on the rural South. We are reinforcing the lack of representativeness in the military because of the concentrated recruiting effort among groups predisposed to serve. Dunlap, they are so focused on getting qualified people. The military is going to the Supreme Court so that it can recruit on campus where currently we're not able to. Cohen, that's just law schools. Dunlap, but it has implications across the armed forces. Bacevich, the recruiters go for the rich turf, which is where the evangelicals are. You have to work a hell of a lot harder to recruit people from Newton and Wellesley, Massachusetts. Cohen, or anywhere in the well-to-do or even middle-class suburbs. Bacevich, in an economic sense, the services are behaving quite rationally, but in so doing, they perpetuate the fact that we have a military that in no way looks like, unquote, American society. Dunlap, the other part of the problem is the behavior of the politicians. They realize the affection that American people have for people in uniform, Bacevich, and so they land on aircraft carriers to prance around in the flight suit of a fighter jock. Both parties now see the military vote as being a part of politics, as a constituency. It's a constituency that the Republicans think they own and intend to continue to own. It's a constituency that the Democrats want to pry away. Cohn, and partisanship in the military overall, i.e. the percentage of the military that identifies with a party as opposed to being, quote, independent, unquote, or non-affiliated, is much greater overall. Not only are military officers more partisan than the general population, they're more partisan than, say, business leaders and other elite groups. I've tracked the numbers of retired four-star generals and admirals endorsing a candidate in presidential campaigns, and it's vastly up in the last two elections. Bacevich, remember the Democratic National Convention where General Claudia Kennedy introduced General John Shalikashvili to address the delegates? What were they up to there? There was only one reason: to try to match the parade of retired senior officers that the Republicans have long been trotting out on political occasions, Cohn. But is that to get military votes or just to connect with the American people on national security and patriotism? Bacevich. It's both. In 2000, the Republican National Committee put ads in the Army Times and other service magazines attacking the Clinton-Gore record. To me, that was quite frankly contemptible. Wasik. It seems as if the two are related. If it's reported that you have the support of the military, as was the case before the 2004 election, when newspapers noted that Kerry had less than 20% support within the military, then you get a halo effect among the rest of the voters. Does the partisanship of our military present a danger to the nation? Cohn. One of the great pillars in our history that has prevented military intervention in politics has been the military's nonpartisan attitude. That's why General George Marshall's generation of officers essentially declined to vote at all, as did generations before them. In fact, for the first time in over a century, we now have an officer corps that does identify, and overwhelmingly, with one political party, and that is corrosive. Cohn. Consider this glaring example of political manipulation by the military. After every other American war before the Cold War, the country demobilized its wartime military establishment. Even during the Cold War, when we kept a large standing military, we expanded and contracted it for shooting wars. But in 1990 and 1991, the military, through General Colin Powell, who was the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, intervened and effectively prevented a demobilization. Bacevich. More accurately, I'd say that he prevented any discussion of a demobilization. Cohn. That's right. Dunlap. We did have a reduction in the size of the military. There were cuts of around 9% in both dollars and manpower. Cohn. But it was nothing compared to the end of the Great American Wars prior to that. Bacevich. Powell is explicit on this in his memoirs. Quote, I was determined to have the Joint Chiefs drive the military strategy train, he wrote. He was not going to have, quote, military reorganization schemes shoved down our throat, unquote. Cohn. This was not a coup, but it was very clearly a circumvention of civilian political authority. Bacevich. Let us also consider the classic case of gays in the military. Bill Clinton ran for the presidency saying he would issue an executive order that did for gays what Harry Truman did for African Americans. He wins the election. When he tries to do precisely what he said he would do, it triggers a firestorm of opposition in the military. This was not the chairman of the Joint Chiefs saying merely in private, Mr. President, I would like to give you my professional opinion, unquote. Cohen. It was the most open revolt the American military as a whole has ever engaged in. Lutwak. Ever? Cohen. Open revolt, yes. Bacevich. Now, Clinton's actions were ill-advised, to put it mildly, but what we got was something like rebellion. Two Marines published an op-ed in the Washington Post warning the Joint Chiefs that if they failed to stop this policy from being implemented, they were likely to lose the loyalty of junior officers. I mean, holy smokes. Dunlap, which brings up the issue. How transparent should the uniformed side of the armed forces be about their opinions? I'll tell you, it is very difficult for serving officers to figure out exactly where the line is. There are points where they feel that their military values require them to speak out. Cohn. I'm not sympathetic. As professional military officers, they are called upon to make far more difficult decisions in far more ambiguous and dangerous situations. The civil-military relationship is one of the most important parts of their profession, and if they are not educated and prepared enough to make the proper judgments, then they don't belong in high-ranking positions. Lutwak. It seems as though we should take into account the views of the armed forces in regard to military questions and nothing more. The military is like a surgeon. If you go to a hospital, even if you own the hospital, you will defer to the surgeon when he tells you that you need your appendix out rather than your leg cut off. But if the surgeon starts talking about religion or politics or homosexuality, you wouldn't defer to him at all. Cohen. But with gays in the military, the officers framed it in military terms. They said that revoking the ban would destroy the good order and discipline of the armed forces. Lutwak, in the showers. Cohen, exactly. In retrospect, it was a foolish argument, but that was how they framed it in military terms. Litvak. So how should it have been done differently? President Clinton comes in and wants to allow homosexuals to serve in the military. Do soldiers have the right to express themselves on this? Cohn. Not publicly. Dunlap. By law, you can contact your congressman. Litvak. Right. Dunlap. That may be the answer. The answer may be you can just do it on an individual basis. Cohn. On a private basis. Litvak. But let's consider a more recent example. One day, General Eric Shinseki, Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, happened to be testifying on Capitol Hill. Somebody asked him about a possible invasion of Iraq, and General Shinseki, reflecting what, as I understand it, was the view of anyone who had ever looked at that country and counted its population, said that it would take several hundred thousand troops to control Iraq. Whereupon Shinseki was publicly contradicted by his civilian superiors, who ridiculed his professional opinion. Dunlap. Right. Dick, do you consider that to have been appropriate feedback for him? Cohen. No. Shinseki behaved appropriately in contradicting and disparaging him. The civilians signaled to the military that they did not want candor even when it's required, which is in front of Congress. Dunlap. There are two other interesting examples with General Pace, our current chairman. One was when he differed with Defense Secretary Rumsfeld about what a military person should do if he or she is present when there's abuse during an interrogation process. Pace insisted that the military had the obligation to intervene, which I think is the right answer. Cohn. But afterward he fudged and claimed that there was no disagreement with the secretary. Dunlap. Be that as it may, I think it was the right answer. The second, and I think more difficult scenario, was when Representative Jack Murtha said that he wouldn't join the armed forces today, nor would he expect others to do so. General Pace publicly criticized Murtha's remarks. Here was another instance in which the senior representative of the uniformed military spoke out in what was arguably a political context against civilian leadership. But in this case, again, I thought it was appropriate. Wasik. So it seems clear that whether we like it or not, the military learned how to use the political system to protect its interests and also to uphold what it sees as its values. Thinking over the long term, are there any dangers inherent in this? Cohn. Well, at this point, the military has a long tradition of getting what it wants. If we ever attempted to truly demobilize, i.e., if the military were suddenly radically cut back, it could lead, if not to a coup, than to very severe civilian-military tension. Bachevich. Because the political game would no longer be prejudiced in the military's favor. Cohn. That's right. Bachevich. But there's a more subtle danger, too. The civilian leadership knows that in dealing with the military, they are dealing with an institution whose behavior is not purely defined by adherence to the military professional ethic, disinterested service, civilian subordination. Instead, the politicians know that they're dealing with an institution that to some degree has its own agenda. And if you're dealing with somebody who has his own agenda, well, you can bargain, you can trade. That creates a small opening again, not to a coup, but to the military making deals with politicians whose purposes may not be consistent with the Constitution. Well, some very interesting reflections there by people of considerable expertise and in many cases related but somewhat different backgrounds. There are a number of things, however, that were not taken into account there, and one of those, of course, is Tacitus referred to in his phrase, pecunia nervus belli, money is the sinew of war. Actually, there was some discussion in that thoughtful article, again, American Coup d'Etat, from Harper's Magazine of April of 2006, of the economic component of military life and military operations. Indeed, I think the Karl von Clausewitz dictum that war is the continuation of politics by other means, when taken into account along with Tacitus' observation that money is the sinew of war, brings us to a very interesting state of affairs. What happens when people, either through neglect and or through a process of deliberate conspiracy, undermine the economy to the point where the society breaks down, including to a certain extent military function? What happens then. And then, I think, is a very, very interesting time indeed, and it's a time that a lot of us need to think about very, very carefully, because this country is bankrupt. As we talked about in the article from the Financial Times that was in For the Record 561, in point of fact, the national debt is much, much, much worse than what the public has been told it is, and that has some very ominous implications indeed. Also, in the context of that particular article, when the military has been misled, and indeed when foreign political forces, along with totalitarian economic forces, are brought to bear within American society, or for that matter, any other society, it can have an enormous effect indeed. By way of sort of underscoring the juncture we've gotten to with regard to the American economy, and thinking how much longer we're going to be able to scotch tape this thing together, the following article is from the Washington Post. It's an article by Amy Goldstein. It's from the Washington Post of Wednesday, June 14th of 2006. Dateline Elkhart, Indiana. It's headlined, Strapped States to Try New Route, Lease Toll Roads to Foreign Firms. How's this for privatization? Dateline Elkhart, Indiana. It reads in part, its official state motto is the Crossroads of America. Yet Indiana is about to turn over its entire toll road for the next 75 years to two foreign companies, making it more expensive to drive. The decision to hand the Indiana toll road to an Australian and Spanish team for a $3.8 billion at the end of this month has blown up into one of the biggest brawls here in a generation. It has unsettled the state's politics in the months before the November elections, pitting a governor who was President Bush's first budget director against the people of northern Indiana, which the highway passes through. The decision also places Indiana at the leading edge of a nascent trend in which states and local governments are exploring the idea of privatizing parts of the United States' prized interstate highway system. The idea goes beyond projects such as Northern Virginia's Dulles Greenway, in which states have turned to private companies to build or widen toll roads. Now, they are considering selling or leasing some of the best known and most traveled routes across America. Consider the same, and consider what is taking place. Again, as we looked at in an op-ed column from the Financial Times in For the Record 561, the real national debt is at this point around $49 trillion. That's trillion with a T-R. That's 1,000 billions, folks. $49,000 billion. That's a lot of money, or as it was put by another analyst, the national debt is such that every American actually owes about $750,000. In other words, every citizen in this country now owes the equivalent of a luxury mansion to the government. But the difference is, as that observer pointed out, all you get is the mortgage. You don't get to live in the house. And sooner or later, that ain't going to work, folks. That just isn't going to work. And so it'll be interesting to see to what extent our institutions are, such as they are able to survive that. Certainly, with fixed elections in many years, including 1980 with the October surprise, relatively well hidden, and with the altogether naked theft of the 2000 election and only slightly less naked theft of 2004, it does remain to be seen to what extent people will find such a development remarkable. But we can only, I guess, hope for the best. Of course, in 1934, there was a coup attempt by some of the most powerful economists, or economic and financial figures in the country. It was unsuccessful, but it came pretty close to succeeding. And on November 22nd, 1963, elements of a similar nature did successfully dispatch John F. Kennedy. And there are many, many programs that talk about that. Now, an earlier assassination, this one unsuccessful, was a November 1950 assassination attempt on President Harry Truman. in a number of broadcasts, notably perhaps for those of you who would like to check it out in detail, for the record 465, we've talked about the Crusade for Freedom, an illegal domestic intelligence operations in which entire SS intelligence units and Central and Eastern European fascist organizations were brought in complete and intact in large numbers, and not only grafted onto the intelligence system and the State Department, but also and especially onto the Republican Party itself, where they evolved into the Republican Ethnic Heritage Branch of the Republican Party, literally a Nazi and fascist branch of the Republican Party with its roots in the axis of World War II and involving overt participation in many cases by notorious war criminals. One of the things that we noted in connection with the development of the Crusade for Freedom was not only its heinous fascist character, but the fact that, again, it was not only part of national policy, but part of partisan GOP politics. Now, in that regard, some of the ruminations by those panel members in that last article becomes very interesting to contemplate. When you've got SS officers, high-ranking SS staff officers and spooks, when they're in many cases war criminals of the most notorious type, when they're doing the political bidding of powerful industrial and financial figures who themselves, because of their great wealth, are prime movers on the political stage, how does that affect the set of variables discussed by those panel members? Very interesting to contemplate indeed. Now, in the past, I've seen references to the assassination attempt on Harry Truman in November of 1950. It was in this precise period that the Crusade for Freedom was taking place, and the goal, basically, was to get rid of the Democrats and Harry Truman, basically. The Republicans felt that Harry Truman stole the 1948 election and that Jews, unquote, were pivotal in that theft because of Harry Truman's support for Israel. So they began importing Nazis and fascists to graft onto the GOP as a counterweight. It is interesting that in this time period, there was an attempt at removing Harry Truman, at neutralizing him politically in an altogether more direct fashion. Some Puerto Rican nationalists tried to assassinate him. There is a new book out about that. It's called, or a recently published book out about that. It's called American Gunfight. It was published by Simon & Schuster and co-authored by Stephen Hunter and John Bainbridge Jr. There was a review of that in the bookshelf section of the Wall Street Journal of Tuesday, November 8th of 2005. This is authored by Alonzo Hamby, himself an author. It reads in part, the article, by the way, the review is titled Terrorists in Washington. And what is interesting about this is that in November of 1950, an election year, an off-year election year like 2006, people who were sort of represented as political low nuts or screwballs, some Puerto Rican nationalists tried to murder Harry Truman at the same time as very powerful fascist elements were maneuvering against him on the Republican side of the aisle. As it turns out, these Puerto Rican nationalists were members of a virulent fascist party in Puerto Rico, the National Party, which in turn had evolved from the international Spanish-speaking fascist organization, the Falange, conceived of and shepherded by Nazi Germany, but operating primarily out of the base of Franco's Spain. I've alluded to vast amounts of material that are available on the Internet. One of those is the book on the Spitfire website, the book Falange by Alan Chase, published in 1943, talks not only about the Falange, an international Spanish-language fascist organization or Spanish culture fascist organization, but its profound links with Puerto Rico and with the Puerto Rican nationalist movement. A German-slash-Nazi cruiser, the Meteor, actually visited San Juan, Puerto Rico in 1938, and it turns out that these terrorists who tried to kill Harry Truman, these Puerto Rican nationalists, were actually fascist operatives. Terrorists in Washington by Alonzo Hamby reads in part, 42 years later, Americans remain transfixed by the assassination of John F. Kennedy, an event that has spawned a cottage industry of articles, books, movies, and film documentaries. Killers who rob a nation of a popular president leave names remembered in infamy. Their success generates 1,000 explanations. Failure, on the other hand, is an orphan. In American Gunfight, unquote, Stephen Hunter, a novelist and film critic, and John Bainbridge, Jr., an attorney and legal journalist, examined the nearly forgotten attempt of two Puerto Rican National Party adherents, Griselio Torriasola and Oscar Collazo, to kill President Harry Truman in November of 1950. Truman was temporarily living in Blair House at the time. Torriasola and Collazo, guns blazing, attempted to storm the residence but never made it inside. The episode occurred 2 days after the National Party had attempted to assassinate Puerto Rican Governor Luis Muñoz Marín and seize control of Puerto Rico. In some way, Torriasola and Collazo imagined Truman's death would further the cause of Puerto Rican independence. And skipping down, of the National Party to which they belonged, to which the would-be assassins belonged, the National Party was a fascist organization with little popular support, led by a would-be Mussolini, supported by a black-shirted militia. In American Gunfight, its operatives are given human identities. By contrast, Governor Muñoz Marín, a widely esteemed liberal whose programs improved the lives of Puerto Ricans, is given little substance. His policemen come across in the book as mere thugs, cardboard figures. In this respect, Messrs. Hunter and Bainbridge inadvertently document the difficulty that liberal societies have in coming to grips with totalitarian terrorism. They are far from alone. Collazo, taken alive, was found guilty of murder and sentenced to be executed. Truman commuted the sentence to life imprisonment, apparently in an effort to appease Latin American anti-Yankee sentiment. He returned to Puerto Rico a hero to the nationalists. President Jimmy Carter, perhaps thinking him a misguided idealist, pardoned Collazo in 1979. Well, one can only wonder to what extent they were operating as part of the International Underground Reich, whose Latin component was the Falange, and which was very deeply rooted in some elements of Puerto Rican society. One name that comes to mind, too, one guiding light of the Republican right at this time, was General Charles Willoughby, who was very close to the Falange, and he'd been MacArthur's chief intelligence officer. One wonders about General Willoughby and his links to Franco, as well as to the Falange and that 1950 attempt. Because, indeed, there is a very dark side that exists to certain aspects of American political life. It's getting darker all the time. And in light of all of the horrible things unfolding on the world stage, it'll be interesting to see just what takes place. In any event, do take advantage of the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. Printed files, audio files, books, sort of a mini anti-fascist library, including the anti-fascist classic Falange by Alan Chase from 1943, the reading of which will flesh out your understanding of the attempt on Harry Truman's life in 1950. There are audio files on that website and also printed files, descriptions of the For the Record shows, links to other websites with both printed and audio files as well. So please check them out. Those of you who only you listen to the program itself are missing a lot of the For the Record experience. Also on the SpitfireList.com website is a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what you hear, there's no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 562, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on July 23rd of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.